Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
That heart is beating fast, and that's the rhythm I can dance to. I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to. That one big heart that's beating fast. Tomorrow morning, let it rain. Tomorrow morning, let it pour. Tonight, we're in the groove together. Ain't gonna worry about stormy weather. Gonna kick all trouble out the door. Beat out old trouble on the drum. Beat out old trouble on the drum. Beat out old trouble on the drum. And kick all trouble out the door. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. And kick all trouble out the door. Kick him out the door. Kick him out the door.
Radical Australia, we're back on Community Radio 3CR, like that dog shit smell you can't get off from the bottom of your shoe. Radical Australia is back. I'm Joe Toscano. Unfortunately, Dale Bridge, co-producer extraordinaire, is stuck in Queensland. No, she has not been arrested. You can relax. I checked up on that. And in her place, we have young Kelly, who is having trouble... Technically, Kelly. Now, what are your problems, Kelly? What are your problems? What are your technical problems?
I can't hear anything through my headphones.
Well, it's because they're not bloody working. You want mine? Because I don't use them.
No, no. I'll get by.
You'll get by. All right. It's very embarrassing having these technical issues when I told our guest here, Mr. Henry Light, that you are the extraordinaire technical expert. You're the Greg. You're the female Greg Siegel. Yeah. What do you reckon about that?
Cool.
Cool, yeah. Henry, you got notes?
Well.
Sorry, turn them over. We don't do notes on this program. It doesn't work that way, mate. This is a radio show.
Yes.
It's a live show. It's live.
Yes.
I ask the questions, you answer them. It's very simple. If you don't need notes, because people think he's fudging it. He's reading.
No, 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 I'm not reading it.
You're just glancing at it. Yeah.
Little hooks.
Yeah, you just look at little my hooks. Eyes. You just look at my eyes. That's what it's about, you know, all right? the control eyes.
Yeah.
Now, Henry, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio. I've heard a lot about you, but I've done no research on you. I'm sorry, because I didn't actually want to. Although we've just had a drink together. I had a cider and you had a coffee.
Yeah.
And Kelly had a wine.
Yes.
So we're all oiled up, Kelly and I, and you're not, so obviously
Henry,
you're...
can you hear everything through your headphones?
Yes, I can.
Oh, that's good, then.
Of course he can. Excuse me, none of this technical garbage, please, Kelly. This is a live show. We're professionals. Dale would never have done that. Okay. Now, Henry, we only asked two questions through the program. You've got 56 minutes to answer them. There's no ads. Do you play any musical instruments?
I do, actually, yeah.
Did you bring it with you?
No.
You're very lucky, because if you do, we actually get you to play.
Yes.
We'll talk about that later on.
Okay.
Well, the first question is, I just want to orientate listeners, not embarrass you. What year were you born?
I was born in 1942, Joe.
42. That's not too old.
Well.
Not too old. You're only 9 years older than I am.
Yeah, so well, this
you're
is
not
true.
Not too old.
Yes.
You know. Have you reached 77 or not?
No, not quite.
Not quite. Okay. All right, and the second question is very easy questions to answer. Obviously, a man of 76 and a bit would know that the answer to this. What's the first thing you remember about being on planet Earth?
That's a trick question, Joe, because you should know that the memory at the age of 76 is not necessarily the same memory when I was 50 or 25.
Well, but the memory you've got now is you.
Yes, but... And it could be a number of memories.
You're trying to fudge it, mate.
No,
what's the first thing you remember?
Well, look, one clear memory whether it's the first, I don't know, but right. it's certainly a clear early memory, and that was at the end of the war when I was holed up in hospital, St. Elizabeth's Hospital or Infirmary in Alkmaar, where I had...
Where?
Alkmaar.
Where's that?
Alkmaar's the north of Holland.
So you're in Holland at the end of the war.
That's right.
Oh.
Yes. In fact, born during the war. So I had diphtheria.
Mm-hmm.
And diphtheria was infectious, and I shared a room with, I think he was a soldier, and he died.
Yep.
And I remember that very clearly because my family, my younger brother hadn't been born at this stage, would visit me on Sundays, and there's a big window, and they'd all be staring at me, pointing the finger at me, and I would be preoccupied, cleaning between my toes, and I look up, and then I saw my family and make the most ridiculous faces at them. I remember that interaction between the family and myself as one of the earliest memories that I've had.
It's quite interesting what you talk about diphtheria. I think people don't understand how bad it was, because when I first graduated, I think, which is a long time ago, 1975, my first job was in the children's ward at the Royal Brisbane Hospital as a young intern, and I was shown the diphtheria bell, which is a bell they had at the children's hospital. If the bell rang, you would know that there's some young kid somewhere choking because of the pus and the swelling of the
neck.
That's
correct.
And as a young doctor, you were told that you'd had to go there and put a knife through some cartilages in the neck and inserted tubes that they could actually survive. You did very well to survive.
Yes, to survive it.
Well, when the young soldier beside you died.
Yes.
You did extremely
well. That made quite an impact on me.
Yeah.
I do recall. I was about 4 or 5 at the time.
Well, it would be, yeah. It would have a huge impact on a little child seeing an adult die beside them. Now, Holland, how many brothers and sisters did you have?
No sisters, 4 brothers.
Are they still alive, the other three?
No, only one brother's alive, so there's 2 of us left.
Right. You have many memories about your parents?
I certainly do.
Well, tell us about your dad.
Well, my dad was born in the Jewish quarter, even though we're not Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
But Amsterdam is a Jewish city. He was born in the Jewish quarter of Amsterdam, and most of his mates were Jews.
Mm.
My father was actually brought up by his grandmother, who used to go up and down the canals on the barges with sacks of flour and what have you.
Mm.
So he wasn't, during his adolescent period, he wasn't actually brought up by his own parents, but by my great-grandmother.
Right.
And he was a typical Amsterdammer, a bit like the East Londoners. Very funny. He was a commercial traveller.
Right.
He was a very...
He didn't have a wife in every port, did he?
No, he wasn't that kind. <Got him. laughs> No, but my father was a commercial traveller and also a cheesemaker.
Right.
And he was, like, on my father's side, they were all funny people.
Mm.
On my mother's side, who were farmers, rather rigid, stodgy, humourless, but very, very moral, upstanding people in the local community.
That's a perfect marriage.
Well,
you got both extremes.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. So I suppose I might have inherited a bit of the complexity or the contradictions of that particular marriage.
Yeah.
But I was very fond of my father. He was an excellent man, never lost heart. I mean, we had a fairly tough time in the beginning when we came to Australia in 1952.
Let's go back a step or two. I want to go back a step or two. Obviously, your father, growing up in the Jewish quarter of Amsterdam during the Second World War, did he ever talk about what happened?
You mean in that quarter?
Yes.
Not a great deal. He was born in 1910, that's just before the First World War.
Mm.
And as I said, he had a lot of Jewish mates.
Mm.
Amsterdam, of course, like most great cities, have gone through their economic recessions and also their...
No, I'm just talking about when the Nazis were there and their anti-Jewish program.
Yes. Oh, no, he wasn't in Amsterdam at the time.
Mm.
He was then... he shifted from Amsterdam to Alkmaar, or his parents had, and he's very conscious of the impact that the Nazis had in Holland. In fact, my father, because he was a commercial traveller, used to visit all the big farms and had a lot of mates who were farmers, and as a result was looked after during the war, and he was given potatoes and so on, which, and he used that to feed the extended family. Mm. But he was also familiar with the resistance.
Yes.
He didn't play a big part in the resistance, but he had contacts. And, of course, the Nazis were indeed ruthless, and a number of his mates were shot. Mm. So the imprint of Nazi tyranny was, you know, we talked about that all the time.
Right.
Yes. In fact, I talk about that. I wrote a memoir, which was called By the Scruff of the Neck. And there I talk about my parents' experiences during the war. I was too young, but my older brothers and my father told me after the war what the conditions were like during the war.
Right. And you got any memories about your mother you'd like to share?
Yes, my mother was a bit of a drama queen. Mm. She was a very good mother, very emotional, could be a little bit manipulative, a bit unstable emotionally. But because my father was like a rock, they somehow worked it through. So I've got nothing but, you know, I love my mother and I love my father. Mm. Probably on balance, preferred my father.
Right.
I shouldn't say that, perhaps. But then on the other hand...
Well, parents have favourite children. Why shouldn't children have a favourite parent?
I suppose so. But also, to be fair to my mother in hindsight, she had five boys and a husband to look after.
Yes.
So she would have... Whereas he had his own way of dealing with the outside community.
Well, yeah.
So it was in some ways easier for him as it was for my mother.
Yeah.
So in fairness to my mother, she had quite a bit on her plate.
Yeah, six men.
Yes, yeah, six men.
Men in the same house.
Well, actually, no, five men and then my younger brother just after the war. Yes.
Right. Okay, so you did mention that you came to Australia. Do you know why your family came to Australia?
Yes, I did. I do. After the war, Europe was in ruins. Holland was in ruins. And people said, well, what are we going to do? And so many duchies, and not only duchies, right throughout Europe, Europeans thought, well, I think migration, I should describe it as the pollen of migration was in the air.
Right.
So that was one reason why we emigrated from Holland to Australia. Another reason, I can now probably say, but I'll say it in general terms, my oldest brother, he was dislocated by the war. In fact, my two oldest brothers were taught to steal from the Germans, and we had a garrison of Germans nearby, and a little blonde boys who went into their tents and then knocked off stuff.
Yep.
We still have some
souvenirs.
Souvenirs from that era.
Yeah.
But because my oldest brother couldn't fit in because of the war, for 5 years he was more or less expected to be a thief and whatever. He couldn't kick the habit after the war and knocked off cars. So that was another reason. And then, of course, there was the I call it propaganda, although I loved the man at the time. There's Arthur Corwell, who was Minister for Immigration, who came to Holland and came to other parts of Europe to promote Australia as this wonderful country because Australia needed manpower, or women power, but certainly manpower at the time.
Yeah.
So those three reasons.
So how old were you when you arrived?
I was nine.
So do you remember anything about when you hit Fremantle?
I certainly do.
Tell us about it.
Well, we came on the Fair Sea, which is one of the sister ships of the Sitma Line, and from Suez, what am I saying? Because it was before Suez was closed in 1956, it was a long stretch from Aden to Australia. Now, when we hit Fremantle, we were allowed to go on land, not for very long, and we thought, what strange place is this? We saw these old shops, double story. I wouldn't say it was dirty, but it was certainly wasn't as clean and tidy as Holland was.
I don't think anything is as clean and tidy as Holland.
Yes. So you had wrought iron balconies.
Yeah.
And we thought, what a weird place.
Yeah.
And then we also, as little kids, we wandered about. I can still remember some of the pubs when you had how shall I put it, the glass exteriors had pictures of old men smoking their pipes.
Yeah, yeah, people that look like me, you know.
Well,
have one at 11,
don't
you know.
Don't put yourself down, Joe. It's very, very distinguished, or extinguished, as someone would say.
Extinguished.
But anyway, the thing is that it had a rougher impression than, I think, Holland was more Dalek and probably a bit more civilised.
Right, right. So where did you end up?
Well, after 52, we went to Melbourne, caught the train to Bonegilla, where, like so many other migrants.
Yes.
And we weren't to be very long. And there was a farmer by the name... No, should I mention his name?
Yeah,
why not?
He'd be dead
by
now.
He is dead by now.
Yes, sir. You can't defame the dead.
Well, his family were okay, but he was an odd bod. His name was Jenkins. And Jenkins flew from the Tasman Peninsula to Bonegilla, lined us up as if we were in a school photograph.
Yeah, yeah.
And he more or less said to the priest, he was also then, yeah, they'll do.
They'll do.
So we then caught, I think, a TA-8 or a Douglas aeroplane to Hobart. And then we went from Hobart to a place called Primadina, which is just past the Port Arthur convict settlement. Now, both my parents were urbanites, townies.
Yep.
And they came to this place, this godforsaken place, in 1952. Couldn't speak the language, nor could any of the boys. Oh, my oldest brother could speak a bit of English. And that's where we landed, and we worked on a mixed farm. There was mixed farming, and so on.
And what was the accommodation like?
Well, there was an old house, which sort of wasn't too bad. And it was previously occupied by, I think, Italian workers. And we had quite a good time. We had to travel to Newbina by bus, an old Bedford bus. And the houses were okay, except the dunny was outside, so we all had to take turns to dig.
What do you think about the maggots and the dunny? You remember the maggots? I still remember the maggots. You'd go out and they'd be, these white maggots in the little tin. You still remember that?
I certainly do. Well, even maggots have a right to...
have a right to exist. They got a good job. And then you'd see the dunny man would turn up, you know. And I was in Queensland, it was much hotter, and they'd have a little scarf around, handkerchief around their head, singlet, they put the shit can on there, and then they trot down, and you think, the maggots, they're falling down his shoulder.
Yes, well, the same applied in Holland too, they had the dunny man too.
Yeah,
so there you go.
Very important job. Yeah, but getting back, so how long did you last in Tasmania?
Oh, not long. We're there for about 6 months because my mother said, I'm going to commit suicide here.
Fair enough.
And my father also, we worked out that we weren't being paid properly.
Right. Well, wage theft. That's an Australian tradition.
I mean, he's going to say wage theft, you know. What's strange. New?
If George can do it, why couldn't
exactly.
Jenkins do it?
So, fortunately, we had a friend who was a baker in Traralgon. And my father wrote to him. He said, look, you know.
Help.
We want to get off this bloody island. And so he said, well, come and stay with me for a while. And there's plenty of work in the Latrobe Valley because they're building the power stations. And that's what happened. We then went to the Latrobe Valley. And we lived in Morwell in the Housing Commission between early 53.
You mean in 1953, yes. Australia was kind enough to give you a housing commission home, and in 2019, following the privatisation binge, we have people I had to step over today on the streets in Melbourne.
Absolutely correct.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
It is extraordinary. In fact, if you go, I shouldn't say because I still have friends and go to Morwell fairly regularly, but I would argue that the houses were cleaner, in better nick than they are now. And the population of Moore was bigger then than it is now. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. But we had an interesting time in Morwell because my father, being a thrifty Dutchman, also decided to sell wood. So we became fuel merchants. The younger boys, and I'm the second youngest, we went round all the houses to collect beer bottles and the older boys...
Submarines, we used to call
submarines,
them.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
And so for sixpence a dozen, we sold the... And plenty of people were drinking beer because beer was the staple drink. Wine didn't exist in those days. So that was Morwell. And then I went.
Did you go to school?
Yes, I went to the Sacred Hearts school in Morwell.
So you were Roman Catholic?
I was brought up a Catholic. Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. And but learned to rebel against it when I was 18. Went
well,
to university.
That's normal.
In fact, that's almost de rigueur, isn't it?
It is de rigueur.
But the thing is that yes, we got a lot of satisfaction in Morwell, but when the two older boys moved to Melbourne. Mm. And the two middle boys were doing reasonably well academically. Yeah. My father said, I think it might be time to make a move to
Melbourne.
To Melbourne. And I was also, I should say this rather immodestly, quite a good soccer player.
Mm-hmm. And played, not that anybody would know what soccer was then.
Well, football. Football. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, but I mean those days, apart
those
from
days,
the English migrants and the Scots.
But anyway, so...
Well, what position?
I was outside left.
Oh, very
Lost
good.
My spleen, in fact, yeah. Playing soccer.
Did you? Where? No, but where?
Oh, this happened when we moved to Australia,
Melbourne.
To Melbourne.
Yeah.
And
who were you playing for?
For Dandenong, but yeah. I was then selected to play for the under-16 state team.
Right.
And in a practice match against New South Wales, and I was fairly quick, and I was a winger.
Yeah. Yeah.
I came in to head the ball into the net.
Yeah.
The goalkeeper, who was about three times my size, came out. But I was quicker. He missed the ball, but he got me right in the solar plexus, and I lost my spleen. It was ruptured in two spots.
Was it diagnosed straight away?
No. In fact, the coach says,
wimp.
We're used to this happens all the time. You get kicked in the guts.
Yeah.
So just go home, have a hot bath, and you'll be right.
Yeah. And you were bleeding to death.
And I was sort of hemorrhaging slowly.
Slowly. That's right.
And then just coincidentally, I had a paper round.
Yeah.
And just outside a doctor's
surgery. You collapsed.
So maybe there was a divine intervention taking place. I collapsed. And my younger brother sort of said, what are you doing? And I said, I didn't have time to say I'm quietly dying here. Knocked on the door of the doctor. And then very quickly ascertained that, yes, it had something to do with it being kicked in the solar plexus on that previous Sunday.
So where did you have a spleen taken out?
When?
Where? Royal Melbourne?
I'm sorry, I'm with you. No, that was at Dandenong Hospital.
Well, you did well to survive.
That's right.
In those days.
Well, in fact, the surgeon who had one leg, he was Welsh rugby player, excellent surgeon, although when you say excellent, if you look at the scar, it was a pretty rough scar, I had to operate quickly because...
Oh, you were dying.
I had the you know more about medicine than I do.
Yeah.
I could have bled to death.
Yeah, you were dying. That's why it's operated quickly.
That's right. My father then would say, yes, but it's a Dutch saying, onkruid vergaat niet, which means weeds will always come up.
Right.
So I'm still here to tell the tale.
Was that the end of your soccer career?
Oh, no. I played soccer then until the age of 43.
Who did you play for?
Oh, I played for Dandenong, but for Monash University for a long time, a little bit for Ferntree Gully, toyed with Ringwood United.
Right.
But it was actually Ferntree Gully. It was my last team I played
you
for.
Do you remember your last game?
I do, because I think there was something snapping in my calf muscle, and I thought someone had thrown a stone at me. But in fact,
Achilles.
And so I said, "Oh, 43 years is happening.
Achilles gone.
I better hang up the Spurs." You know.
You never took up coaching.
No, but as a teacher, I often coached sides. And
It would be unusual for a young Dutch lad immigrant to go to a Monash. How did that happen?
A very good question. I was taught by Barry Jones. The Barry Jones. Yeah. He was my teacher for three years.
Was a $64 million man or something?
He was the quiz champion.
Yeah.
And the fact is that Dandenong High School, which is one of the older high schools, was, as it is today, a multicultural school.
Yes.
Although a different composition.
That's right.
So there were a lot of Russians there, Germans there, Serbians, Dutchies.
The Bolts. Yeah.
There were no people from Asia.
Yeah.
In any case, why Monash? Because it was still quite formal and rigid. I did Latin. I did, so the teachers...
Hang on. What year did you get into Monash?
Oh, in 1962.
But it's unusual for people to go to university in 1962. So how come you went to university?
That's right. Well, my father also always favoured learning. He said, look, the best thing you can do is study, read books, do well at school and work hard. They're the sort of twin. Mind you, there's nothing new in that.
No, most
parents say that.
All immigrants say that.
That's right. But there was a shortage of teachers at the time. So Menzies, that's probably one of the good things that Menzies did, made studentships available.
Right.
Coming from a poor migrant background, I just latched onto the bursary and... as a result of that, through my matric results, I got into Monash.
Mm. And how long were you at Monash for?
Now, Monash, the first degree was... First degree was 3 years.
Yep.
Because I was bonded with the education department and...
you did 3 years and then you went out?
3 years, did the Diploma of Education.
Right.
Became a teacher.
For but 3 years.
I did well enough in politics to...
Hang on.
Yeah, I'm going too
62, fast. 62, 63,
63, 64,
65.
It's my dip-ed year.
Dip-ed year. And when did you come back?
And then I was appointed to a tech school. It's my first school, Noah Park Tech. Mm. But I was very interested in politics at the time.
Yeah.
So I did politics at lunchtime.
At Monash
to finish off that major.
What year?
And that was in 1966.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, I was...
You weren't one of those people we saw at the LBJ protest.
Oh, possibly.
In 66? Well, that wasn't you, was it?
No, it wasn't
You didn't embarrass the country, did you?
No.
You sure? You look familiar.
Yeah, I look familiar. I could have been there, but then, as I said, the memory plays tricks. No. But the thing is, I then went back and did a master's on Tolstoy.
Tolstoy. Why Tolstoy?
Because I was going to do a comparison between Leo Tolstoy and Friedrich Nietzsche, and my supervisor, Harry Redner, a good man he is, and he's still with us, thank goodness. He said it's too big a canvas. Mm. I mean, I can see why you want to contrast and compare the two.
Yeah, it is a big canvas.
It's a big canvas.
For a master's it is.
Yes. So he said, why don't you just select one or the other?
Mm.
And I've always been impressed with Tolstoy when I read What I Believe, which I read in the Monash Library, I think about 63, 4.
Mm.
And I've always been attracted to Tolstoy's, not only his literature, but also his anarchism. So I decided to do...
So are you still a Christian?
Am I a Christian? Mm. Oh, no.
No, I mean, Tolstoy was a Christian anarchist.
I was going to say, Tolstoy had his own particular take on Christianity.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
He was first and foremost what I'd call an 18th century rationalist, leaving aside his literary imagination, which, of course, became evident in Anna Karenina and War and Peace and Resurrection and Master and Man and a host of other smaller works. But he was a rationalist. He was very much influenced by Voltaire, Kant, and so forth, and Rousseau. And while he became a Christian, he was never very active in the Orthodox Church.
No.
And developed his own brand of Christianity. Mm. The Kingdom of God is Within You is one of his better-known essays.
Mm.
And basically he was saying, take the Gospels as they are, the Sermon on the Mount, which became a kind of, the foundation of his Christianity. So, yes, he was a Christian, he was a pacifist. I was very much attracted to the pacifist side of his anarchism. I don't subscribe to his rational analysis of the Gospels for a host of reasons.
Yes. All right, that's interesting. So have you done any more work on Tolstoy since?
Well, I haven't touched Tolstoy for many, many years.
Right.
But I was invited, because I did most of my research in England, and I was very fortunate to have been in the company of the great man Sir Isaiah Berlin, because he came out and did a series of lectures, and Harry Redner said, get yourself known, and then quiz him when you get to England. So I visited Isaiah Berlin in 76 at All Souls College, and the great man was there, and I asked him about Tolstoy.
Mm.
coincidentally, while I was in his room, he picked up the phone to talk to Boris Pasternak's sister. It was also the time of the dissidents, yes. the cutoff and so on.
Mm.
And so he said, so you want to do work on Tolstoy? He himself, of course, yep. has written on Tolstoy.
Mm.
The Hedgehog and the Fox is probably may come to mind. But he actually pointed me in the direction of a number of people. One of them was John Bailey, who happens to be the wife of Iris Murdoch, who's a tall, bumbling sort of fellow, who, lovely man, and wrote, I think, a work on Anna Karenina. But I became very chummy with a fellow called Ronald Sampson. Professor Ronald Sampson worked at Bristol University. Mm. He was a Lancashire man, and he and I became good mates.
Mm.
And as a result of that friendship, when there was a colloquium put on at the United Nations in 1988, for some reason I got a Guernsey to go over and give a paper on Tolstoy, which I did.
Right.
In fact, I've got a copy here.
How did that go? Don't read it.
No, I'm just... No, it was called Tolstoy's Death, Imperative and Civilization.
And how did the paper go? How was it received?
I think it was well received. Well, I mean, how do I know?
You don't know. Well, people come and pat you on the back later on and say, that was all right. Yes. That was all right, John. That was okay.
But you see, it had something like 20 Tolstoy scholars from all over the world.
Oh, right.
And my Russian is pretty well non-existent.
Yeah.
But I think Justice Tolstoy was fascinated by the notion of death.
Mm.
Which negates. He was a passionate man.
We're all fascinated by death. The notion of death, I can assure you that. Look, it's 4:33. This is Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. I'm having a chat, it's not an interview, with Henry Light, or Licht, L-I-C-H-T, is that correct?
Yes, that's
yeah, I have a terrible pronunciation. Henry Licht or Henry Light.
Make it light, yes.
Or make it light, yeah. A light beer is always good.
Make it light work.
And if you've missed a bit of the program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. Now, I'm going to fast forward a little bit, Henry. So how did you earn a living? You know, you're an old man now. How did you earn a living?
How did I earn a living?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I was just a teacher.
Just a teacher.
A teacher. Yes.
Socrates. You were a Socrates.
I was.
Just a teacher.
Yes.
What do you mean, just a teacher?
No, my teachers. Yes, I taught for 35 years.
35 years.
And became a...
Obviously, you were a private school teacher.
No, I was very much a high school. On principle, I would never teach in a private school.
Why is that?
Well, because private schools are what I would say allied with the capitalist class, put it that way.
Yes.
And whereas I think, according to our own constitution, we live in a secular society. Private schools are schools for privileged people.
So you taught for the elites. For 35 years in the public sector.
I did.
And how do you feel that those 35 years were spent? Well spent or waste of time?
No, I enjoyed my teaching very much.
Mm. What did you teach?
I taught history.
Mm-hmm.
I taught politics. Taught German. I studied a bit of German. And literature.
Mm-hmm.
What
areas? What areas? In Melbourne?
Victoria, yes. Mainly around Melbourne. But I also taught in New South Wales at Fort Street.
Yeah.
I also taught in England in 76. I've taught in China.
Yeah.
But essentially my teaching career was in Victoria. In the public sector.
Have you seen any changes in the last few decades?
Well, you're asking someone who's been out of teaching.
No, but when you were in teaching.
Oh, yes. Education never stays the same.
Mm.
It's in a constant state of flux. It reflects certain trends. It also reflects the socioeconomic situation we're in, technological developments and so on. I would say one big difference from when I was teaching is the impact of computers and also mobiles and what have you. Mm. Teaching hasn't changed that much, in the sense that you've got a class, it's up to you to be able to control them, impart knowledge, and make sure you like kids, and I've always liked kids, and make sure that you communicate what you want to impart to them.
Now, over the last 35 years of teaching, say the 35 years you did, when did you retire about?
I retired from secondary teaching in 1998.
All right, let's go. Say you taught, what, for about, what,
35 years in secondary.
In secondary. Did you notice any change in the students? Or are students always the same?
In essence, I think students pretty well stay the same.
Mm-hmm.
They've got their peer group pressures. They've got their petty little, you know, concerns.
Mm-hmm.
As I said earlier, I think the impact of technology in all sorts of ways, and I regard technology as a bit of a double-edged sword,
mm-hmm.
Has had quite an impact on students. Are students nastier than they were in my earlier days? Probably not, but there is potential to become nastier through what I call cyberbullying, for example.
Mm.
But in essence, really, kids don't change that much.
So irrespective of what's happening around them.
Yes. I mean, kids like to be the sense of self-esteem that they've got. They're very unsure of themselves because I think adolescence is just a turbulent period of their lives.
Mm.
And adults often don't sort of tune in to their concerns.
Mm.
I've always liked young people. I'm not so keen on old people, as I said earlier.
Well, I can understand. You're talking to an old person here, and you did show me a bit of disrespect when you were walking to the studio.
Yeah, the fact that I'm 8 years older or thereabouts.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reason, and I think we have to put much more time into young people. I think they're getting.
Do you think it's worth? You don't think we're putting the time in?
Well, I think the older people know. Mm. I think there is less tolerance of kids. The fact is that it's so much more difficult in a way for young people now than it was when.
Yeah, well, like your brother, he would have been put in a juvenile detention.
He'd be in juvenile detention. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, and he would have his life would have gone to a different trajectory. You know,
who knows?
Who knows?
Yes.
No, seriously. But I mean, I think there's no room for forgiveness anymore in our society. It's just, you know, it's just judgmental. It's so judgmental. I've never actually remembered a period where society has been so judgmental. You know, it's just extraordinary.
Political correctness and what have you.
No, I'm just judgmental. Somebody makes a little mistake and it's the end of their life, basically, you know?
Yes, yes. I'm out of the education circus now.
No, I'm just saying generally.
But generally, I'm not sure about that.
Mm. So you think we're more forgiving?
I mean, you're making sort of a judgment based on what?
On my own personal experience.
I mean,
what I see around me, I see, you know, like in the past, we kind of forgive somebody and say, oh, well, he's done that, or she's done that. They're going to turn around at some stage. But today, just bang, 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 as we saw with the experience of the African kids, you know, in the northern suburbs. It was just extraordinary, that constant attack by all sections of society.
Oh, there is. In that sense, yes, there is a kind of, I suppose, there's a hypersensitivity now in our society now. And there is you get the impression that possibly has been heightened by media exposure.
Yes, yes.
Where, in fact, yes, the African kids are picked on. And, of course, I've taught Vietnamese kids, I've taught Chinese, I've kids from all kinds of nationalities.
Mm.
And one good thing about Australia over a long period of time, and I'm not so sure whether it's happening now because I'm out of touch, there was a considerable tolerance and we put up with kids from different backgrounds and we didn't pick on them and put them inside. You get the impression that this is happening a little bit more because it may suit, you know, certain
political
agendas.
Yeah. Now, getting back, you retired from secondary teaching in 88.
And no, 98.
98, sorry. And obviously you went and played golf, did you?
Oh, no. I look upon golf, and it might be a great sport for many people.
For old people, yeah.
It's one of those...
So what did you do? What did you do?
So what did I do? I then got a job at Victoria University in education, and I lectured both secondary and primary aspiring teachers, student teachers.
What was that experience like?
Terrific. My bosses were women,
mm-hmm.
and they were wonderful. Brenda Cherednichenko, she was actually an Aussie girl married to a Ukrainian, obviously, mm-hmm. with that name. Mm-hmm. I think she's now at Deakin University.
Mm-hmm.
Maureen Ryan was another one. And it was wonderful working for them. Now, Victoria University is different in the sense that a lot of the kids came from the western suburbs. And so they weren't, you know, your people who went to Melbourne University or Monash or what have you. And I liked the kids there. They weren't as bright, I suppose, or as challenging as perhaps students from some of the other universities. But the ethos was good. I enjoyed my time at Victoria University.
Mm. So why did you finally retire? Were you told that you're too old?
No. In fact, technically speaking, I'm still on their books.
All right.
I left partly because, well, I was 63, 64. I always wanted to do a bit of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other reason I had to travel from Melton and from Footscray and from Sunbury
to
the Dandenong, so I got sick of that.
Yeah.
And probably the third reason was that I began to detect quite a bit of cheating, plagiarism,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't like that, and that also went into the equation.
So, you think the World Wide Web, as you said, is a two-edged sword?
It's a two-edged sword.
Like most technology.
Yes, that's right.
All right, so now before we get on to what you've done since you retired, well, retired from paid work. From life. Have you got any children?
I've got two sons.
Two sons. How old are they?
45 and 42.
Do they follow your footsteps in education?
One of them, yes. The second son is a music teacher,
right.
And he's a musician and plays four or five instruments, and including the Illan pipes.
The what?
Illan pipes. You know, the Gaelic.
The Gaelic pipes.
The
sheep thing under the...
Yeah, the elbow pipes.
Well, yeah, yeah.
So he he's actually a percussionist. He's a drummer, professional drummer.
Right.
And the other son's also an excellent musician and has got a wonderful voice and writes music. And so they're creative, artistic.
Are you still married? Or
This is my second marriage.
Second marriage,
yes.
Right.
I was married to my ex-wife, with whom I get on very well.
Mm.
She's English. Mm. And my second wife is a Punjabi Sikh from Singapore.
From Singapore.
Right. Yes. So that's...
What, did you meet in Singapore? Or?
No, I met here in Melbourne.
Oh,
yes. Yes.
And life in the Dandenongs is all right?
That's right. Yeah. And, of course, I've now embraced the Sikh culture, and I'm part of it. I know many Sikhs.
Why have you embraced it? Apart from your wife being are you interested in the Sikh culture?
Well, I mean, I'm interested in all cultures.
Right.
It's just that she, being a devout Sikh, then goes to Blackburn Temple.
Yep.
And a lot of people go there because they've got kitchens attached.
Mm.
And they're a very sociable religion and also very egalitarian.
Mm.
And, in fact, the only other white who's there regularly, apart from myself, not that I'm a believer, is Greg Sheridan, of all people.
Right.
So he and I sometimes, you know, we get our swords and pick on one another, but we get on pretty well.
Now look, I'm going to ask a very crude, ignorant question. How does every sing know every other sing? And how does every princess know every other princess?
Well, they don't.
They don't, right. How do you work it out?
But that's, of course, you're right. Sing means lion, of course.
Yes.
And that's just a kind of an honorary thing that they all adopt.
Yeah.
And the same applies to women.
Yeah.
They apply the word core, K-O-U-R.
Yeah.
And that's just one of those peculiar things. No. The Sikhs are a bit like the Jews, the Chinese, like a lot of migrants, the diaspora. They're all over the place.
Because I have noticed there's a new temple springing up at Water Gardens. I've noticed a bit of activity up there.
Yes, I think there are about six Sikh temples around Melbourne.
So what research have you been doing lately?
Oh, well, that's a very broad question.
It's a broad interview.
Well, it's a broad interview, that's right. New Guinea, I've just been asked to, I don't know whether it's time to talk about that now.
Yeah, it is, look.
Yes, I don't know how we go.
Perfect timing. Yeah, perfect timing, if you know.
Anyway,
that's my job. I look at the clock.
All right. Okay. All right.
Well, you just look at your notes, which you've closed, which is good.
Yeah. I'm being embarrassed here. This is very. Can I handle it? I suppose I can. Well, the thing is that I've been involved only peripherally, I suppose, for the last 20 years with the West Papua Freedom Movement, or MEDEKA, that you're familiar with, and I've known Jacob Rumbiak and Louise Byrne for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Louise came up with a proposition about 18 months ago, 2 years ago. Hard to remember that exactly.
Right.
How about, I've discovered this book.
Who discovered this? Louise?
Louise discovered it. Mm. And she approached me and said, well, you're a clogwog. Mm. So how about, can you translate this book? And I said, well, I'm also trying to write a novel. I'm also involved with a couple of other organisations. Not very keen. My Dutch is pretty good, but it's not brilliant.
Mm.
So, well, how long is it? And she said, oh, it's 100 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing I've already translated a few diaries, Dutch diaries, for a friend of mine to do with the Jewish diary, actually. Mm. And it's a bit of a challenge, and I said, oh, I don't really want to do it, but all right. So my conscience, my guilt, which is probably a legacy in my Catholic days.
Well, it does. Oh, guilt's very important.
Guilt is it's a great spur, actually.
It is, it is.
And I said, well, all right, I'll do the 100 pages, but where is it?
Where is it?
And then Louise says, oh, no, it's not really, not for me to chase it up, it's for you to chase it up.
She knew the title.
She knew the title.
Did she know the author? Google. Did she know the author?
Yes.
Right.
His name was...
Well, she did half the work for you.
Yes, half the work, I don't think so. Anyway, so I then pursued it and discovered a copy at an old antiquarian bookseller in Leeuwarden, which is the capital of Friesland, one of the provinces, and I found the book.
Can I tell you a story which mirrors your story? You know Raphael Carboni? He was one of the radicals in the Eureka Rebellion,
The Eureka Rebellion.
He wrote an opera called Gubernia, which was about the exploitation of Aboriginal people. He saw them as victims of colonialism, British colonialism. Yes. The first time in Australian white history that it was lost. There was this academic from Monash was wandering through the streets of, I think, Turin, and saw this bookstalls on the street. And he went and he found a copy of Gubernia and translated it into English.
Well,
and now we're waiting for somebody to put on the play.
Is it a good play?
Oh, no, it's an opera. Opera.
Is it a good opera? I mean, well.
What opera is good? All right, so this is your story.
No, I love opera. But
all right, tell us. So you got this. You found it?
So I found it.
Yeah.
And there was a dear old lady who ran the antiquarian bookshop.
Yeah.
She wrote to me in Dutch, and she'd never heard of PayPal.
Yeah.
But I managed to get money to her, and then I got a copy. Mm. It was published in 1956, and pretty well went out of print.
Yes.
And it's just a ripper of a book.
What's it called?
It's called Wij Vochten in het Bos, which translates as We Fought in the Jungle.
And who's the author? A
fellow called Maurice Cockerlink.
Right.
Now, Maurice Cockerlink was an Indo.
What's an Indo?
An Indo, he happened to be three quarters Dutch, as in, you know, his parents, his father was born in Holland and his own grandparents. And his mother was quarter Javanese.
Mm-hmm.
He was born in central Java.
Right.
And Indos, I don't like the term very much, but...
It's like
Anglo-Indians.
Yes,
indeed. Now, they had been in the Dutch colony for hundreds of years and, by and large, weren't too badly treated, and provided they adopted the father's name, they were pretty well accepted. There was still a pecking order, as it always has been, but it's nothing like apartheid.
Right.
Where it was very clear-cut where the Dutch Boers, who were Protestants, looked upon the blacks as inferior and so on.
Yep.
But this wasn't the case in Indonesia. They were pretty well accepted. Now, the reason why I make that point is that the Indos regarded themselves as Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
So when Cockerlink, who had already enlisted in KNIL, the Koninklijke Nederlandse Indische Leger, which means the Royal Indonesian Dutch Army.
Mm.
He had already did his service and was a crack shot, and I think he was about 18 at the time. But when he was 20, he decided to emigrate to Dutch New Guinea, or West Papua, as we know it now. That New Guinea was regarded as the land of milk and honey. Mm-hmm. Just as transmigration had been with us since time immemorial. In fact, Australia's been settled as a transmigration country, really, when you look at the convicts. He went to New Guinea in 1933 to make his fortune.
Yep.
He was after, I'm going to find gold.
Gold, yeah.
And I'm going to find cassowaries and sell the meat and the feathers and whatever.
Typical Dutch.
Anyway, so what happened was that this wasn't the case when he arrived. Mm. It's very poor, very backward. And he worked for someone for a while and then after 6 years set up his own farm, mainly pig farming. Mm. And he was happy. He was a very a free agent, in the sense that he didn't want to be bothered.
Yep.
He hated the army that he was in earlier. Mm. He was a free spirit. Mm. And then, of course, on the 7th of December, 1941, Pearl Harbor occurred. And 2 months later, the Japanese began bombing Manokwari, which is the main city, the capital city of Fohokop or Bird's Head, or West Papua. And that meant his little farm was bombed, and he didn't like it. And so he was called upon by the then captain who was of the garrison in Manokwari, and his name was Captain Willems Geroms, another hero. And he joined his particular band of guerrilla fighters because the Japanese meant business. Mm-hmm. They bombed the shit out of that northern coast of the Fohokop and were very nasty, plus propaganda that they were already, spreading. Yep. And Geroms worked out very quickly that it's no good taking them on, but we're going to be obliterated.
Yep.
And so they said, let's go into the jungle and let's retreat. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know how much time I've got left.
You've got 5 minutes.
Yeah, all I'm saying is, but poor old Captain Willems Geroms in 1944 became very ill because retreating into the jungle in West Papua, you're retreating into
malaria country.
Malaria country, disease left, right, and centre.
Yeah.
Plus, of course, the contact with the tribes.
Yep.
The Japanese mainly confined themselves to the coast.
Right.
And there were, in fact, 1,100 Japanese sent out to look for this Kokalink and Geroms and obliterate them. The fact that they retreated into the jungle and took pot shots at the Japanese and eliminated a hell of a lot, a couple of hundred at least, meant that the Japanese were very frightened of this guerrilla group. There was, I think, 10,000 guilders put on the head of Kokalink. Mm. See, Kokalink took over from Geroms because Geroms became very sick, probably mentally affected. And so he was going to take over the remaining group, and there were 62 to start off with, and at the end there were only 14 who survived it.
Right.
So Kokalink, who just showed fantastic leadership, from a carefree, easygoing chap, he was intelligent, resilient, tough as nails. As I said earlier, excellent shot, and he was a good tactician. He managed to break up his little group, the smaller groups, he says smaller targets.
Right.
And the Japanese just loathed him and despised him. And he managed to survive, even though the Dutch government didn't know in Jakarta that they existed.
Yes.
And the reason why they knew they existed is because there was a Japanese ship which was captured by the Allies, and there were bullet holes everywhere. Where? And where did the bullet holes come from? So the captain of the Japanese ship said that, in fact, yep, all right. So
no, it's fine.
Anyway.
Yeah, so this Sunday.
Yes.
4th of August.
Yes.
1 p.m.
Yes.
838 Collins Street, Docklands.
Absolutely.
At the back there.
That's right.
At the conference room. We're having our regular fourth monthly meeting. West Papuan office open day, Wren Collective open day, lunch at 1 p.m, and the main attraction is you.
Oh, I don't think so.
Well, it is. It is. Because, look, if you want to find out more about this story, and their relationship with the West Papuans and what it has to do with the West Papuan independence movement. This is fresh stuff off the press, and you want a signed, personally signed autographed copy for a little bit of cash, around 30 bucks, I think. Come along. You're all invited. It's easy. You don't have to be a member of the Rent Collective. You pay $15 for lunch. And if you don't want lunch, you pay nothing. You just get a cup of coffee. And if you're a member of the Rent Collective, which is $1 a month, as you all know, you pay nothing for lunch. And you listen to John Light.
Henry Light.
Sorry, what I was talking about. Henry Light.
That's my second name.
Yeah, Henry John Light. Henry John Light. You listen to Henry John Light. This is extraordinary. This is just as more important than Gilburnia. This is extraordinary.
It's comparable to Weary Dunlop's diaries.
Yeah.
And, of course, Flanagan's book about the narrow road to the deep north.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'll have a little bit to say about those.
Yeah, no, it's comparable.
Because they're comparable.
It's extraordinary. And what happened? I assume he's died now.
Cockerling died in 1994. He was born in 1913.
Yeah.
He was sent back to Holland in 1962.
Right.
And he was working in toilets. They treated him very badly.
Right.
So he said, that's it, I'm going to emigrate to Dutch Guiana,
right.
Suriname, and that's where he died, outside Kien.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. It's a Shakespearean tragedy when you look at it.
Yes.
But it's an extraordinary story. And I congratulate you on finding the book. I congratulate Louise on actually finding the book initially, but on you doing all the work. She's the show pony. You're the draft horse. So if you want to see the draft horse, you want to see Henry Light, come along. Henry John Light, Licht, L-I-C-H-T. Come along, 1 p.m. this Sunday, 4th of August, 838 Collins Street, Docklands. This is an extraordinary historical moment. Even if you're not a member of the Rent Collective, we don't care. Turn up. I'm going to buy a signed copy, in which I never buy books, but I'm going to buy a signed copy because this is just as important, in my opinion, as Gilburnia. Thank you, Kelly. You're not as good as Dale, but you will get there after a few years. But you are an extraordinary, you know, you're a Mr. Siegel's heir apparent, I think. Thank you very much, Henry, and thank you very much, listeners. And listen in to Radical Australia next week, where we will have another extraordinary guest.
And now that heart is beating fast, and that's the rhythm I can dance to. I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to that one big heart that's beating fast. Tomorrow morning, let it rain. Tomorrow morning, let it pour. Tonight, we're in the groove together. Ain't gonna worry about stormy weather. Gonna kick old trouble out the door. Beat out old trouble and drunk. Beat out old trouble on the drum. Beat out old trouble on the drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Kick him out the door.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.